All right, y'all, we are back for another episode. And today we are going to be talking about this overlap of selective mutism and autism. You might, listening to this right now, not have even heard of selective mutism. So that is some of what this education is going to be about today, as well as for your autistic child, is this something that you should be considering? Selective mutism is a form of anxiety. And we do see in autistic children that selective mutism can be a common diagnosis. So we are going to dive into that. Welcome to a parenting space actually designed for you, where you can get answers about navigating a life that includes autism. I'm Dr. Tay, a licensed child psychologist and parental coach specializing in neurodivergent affirming care. I have supported hundreds of autistic children and their families and have been in the autism field for over a decade. And I know firsthand the impact autism can have. I was 12 years old when my little brother was diagnosed and my family had to learn how to navigate the autism journey. It wasn't always easy. 2 decades later, I now create resources and services I wish my family had, including this podcast, and I developed the whole family approach. On this podcast, of course, we will talk about autism, but we will also talk about your personal growth and well-being as a parent, supporting your non-autistic children, and sharing personal stories of other families so you know you're not alone. Quick disclaimer before we jump into today's episode. Anything shared on this podcast should not be considered clinical advice, and you should consult with your team of medical, mental health, and developmental providers if you need support. I'm so excited to have my dear friend here today. We actually met through Instagram and just have really connected and hit it off. So Eleanor Ezel, she is a licensed clinical social worker. I mean, licensed clinical social workers are amazing, but she is next level with all the experience that she has. We love being able, just as clinicians, to consult with each other and pick each other's brains about our areas of specialty, given we do see so much overlap. So, Eleanor, welcome. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me. We've been trying to get this on the books for a while. Our busy schedules finally aligned, which is really exciting. Yeah, so I'm a LCSW. I'm licensed in Mississippi and Tennessee, and I have a private practice and where I specialize in treating kids with selective mutism and behavioral disorders. So kids with ADHD, oppositionality, a lot of autism, and a lot of co-occurring disorders between all of those things. I see a lot of very complex cases that a clinician needs a second opinion to kind of figure out what's going on. And so I tend to be brought in to work with parents and go from this like parent training model to take a 30,000 foot view and then to kind of zero in on what is actually going on to get to the right diagnostic profile for a kid to help benefit them and make sure that we're using the right research to help them be who they are and feel strong and feel regulated and be able to access their life. And one of the things, I've said this to you many times, Taylor, but my greatest joy, I think, is how I describe it, is giving kids their childhood back. And so that's kind of how we talk about it. And when we look at co-occurring diagnostics, that is very important, looking at the whole child, not just one piece of it. So I'm excited about this conversation today.
Absolutely. Tell the listeners a little bit about your training, how you started specializing in selective mutism, as well as behavioral disorders, and also touch on your training on neurodevelopmental disorders and development broadly.
Yeah. So when way back in college, I did this really great summer internship with my long-term mentor, a man named Stephen Kurtz up in New York, who specializes in SM. And so I got really early training in how to work with a child with anxiety, and especially this like very specific form of anxiety that is so incredibly impairing. And we'll define what SM is in a little bit. But I went to NYU. I did professional training with him as well, ran his practice for a long time. And then really got into SM then, and also PCAT. And then down the road, I did a fellowship in Mississippi, a developmental behavioral pediatric fellowship on a federal grant through HRSA, which was amazing. And we had a multidisciplinary team. So we're all cross-trained in OT, speech, behavioral, which is my specialty, and then also the psychology and medical pieces of child development. And so every single child that our clinic saw everybody. And so we were able to cross train and get really good at figuring out exactly what was going on, functions and behaviors, and understand things, not just from one perspective, but making sure that we are looking at the environment, the genetics, the learned behaviors, things that are just in a person, and how to kind of balance those things in terms of developing an appropriate treatment plan.
Yeah. And I think care like that is next level. And if parents listening can find a team like that, go for it. I think if not, it's really working with clinicians who have received training like that, that go above and beyond and aren't just thinking in terms of their own modality and how they were trained and are continually learning and evolving. So I love it.
I totally agree. And it's one of the reasons both you and I do this, that we use our cross training, as we would call it in the industry. We use our cross training to reach out. My practice is called Child and Family Therapy Collective for a reason, because it's not about me. It's about the collective family. And my patients will joke all the time. You're like, oh, I get it now. This is a collective effort. It's not just the behavioral perspective. And just looking at any one person, looking at an adult from one perspective is not sufficient, especially in this day and age when everything is so complex. And so we have to look for multiple perspectives and talk to lots of different professionals to make sure that we're getting it right.
Yeah. Professionals, and I would add, because I know you do this, is parents too. And they are absolutely part of the team and have so much expertise in their child. Yeah. What do you call them? The captain, you said?
I call them the captain. Well, the kid's the captain. And the parents are the co-captains.
I love it.
And then I'm the coach.
So fun. So fun. All right. Let's dive into selective mutism, or SM. What is it?
So selective mutism is a childhood anxiety disorder. And we say childhood because onset is during childhood for a typical progression of SM. And the anxiety it presents in a way where a child is unable, not unwilling, but unable to speak in certain social environments. If you look at a typical case of SM, oftentimes these kids have a really difficult time verbalizing in school, at play dates, at the grocery store, at the doctor, but at home they are loud and storytelling. They're learning throughout their day at school, but they are just completely quiet. And so these kids, they really struggle to engage verbally, which is different from the physical manifestation of anxiety, which would be more social anxiety, which is really common. About 70% of kids with SM also have social anxiety, but you can have one or the other or both. But we do often see kids with SM who have that physical inhibition as well. But categorically, selective mutism is the verbal inhibition of speech in some environments, but not all. And what's really interesting is that the way I call it their formula, like what is their anxious formula, like what keeps them safe? Each kid's formula is going to be a little bit different. It could be defined by types of people, places, certain activities, certain content. I've had kids who are able to tell me anything about dinosaurs, and then any other topic that's academic is completely off limits because it's too hard, or because the boundary seems to be that I'm not an expert on it already. It's too nerve-wracking to feel that distrust to talk about that topic. So there's some interesting presentations that we see, but typically it's more location-based.
That makes sense. I will say, you know this, but I've done some training in SM during my graduate school career, and it was just amazing to learn because it really, yes, it's an anxiety disorder, but there's also really special things about it and how we're going to talk about treatment and how we approach that and all of that. But I think it's super interesting to think of this content idea, and we'll get into this a little later in the episode, but particularly with that autism overlap, it's like, are they just able to talk about their passions, but maybe, or their special interests, but not talk about other areas too, which will be interesting for us to piece apart.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just so interesting because, like, you can be anxious about, I don't know, if I like dogs a lot, I can feel really confident talking about dogs and really not confident talking about cats if I don't know anything about cats. And so it's not uncommon that I'm glad we're having this conversation because it's not uncommon that we say, is that a special interest or is that just something that's more comfortable? And they know that they're going to get the answer right. And this child is avoiding potentially being wrong. And so we'll kind of dive into that more, I know, but it does come up a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. What age are you often seeing onset of this?
Typical onset of SM is around preschool. So when kids start going to school or if they are going to daycare, usually around 3, you'll start to see me. Some kids, you start to see it earlier, or when you're looking historically, you'll be like, oh, maybe they were less verbal when they were 2, but it's kind of hard to diagnose. Our clinical measures, they start at age 3 though. So most of my kids, I would say, had a clear presentation of SM around age 4 or 5 going into kindergarten, pre-K or kindergarten.
Yeah. And I think an important distinction is for parents of autistic children who are listening to this right now, your child has to have a baseline verbal ability though. Yeah. So we're really looking at discrepancy. And so I have heard parents be like, is this SM? My kid isn't talking at all. And that is a distinct presentation where it is a language delay.
Yeah. And so the difference in if you're looking at patterning, I talk about patterns a lot and the function of a behavior. So is, and we'll keep coming back to that phrase, function of behavior. If you work with me, you know that we talk about this a lot for every kid. But the function of a behavior is, at home, am I functionally able to use language the way I am now? But it's as if there's a line drawn at my front door. And when the mailman comes by, I look out and then I stop talking. If mom or dad asks me a question, I'm not able to answer them because there's a presence of somebody, something in the environment changed that makes me too anxious to be able to use my voice. And so another example of that might be getting onto school property. Maybe that's the boundary, but that's going to be different than a person who is nonverbal overall, and maybe might benefit from the use of an AAC device or something like that. That's going to be more of a language delay or difference versus an anxiety disorder where you're seeing a difference between home, school, and community. If it's consistent across different places, then it's most likely not SM.
Yeah. Fun little like backstory here. So there's been actually this shift from calling it nonverbal to now calling it non-speaking because only because I think it's relevant here is in this distinction, right? It's like an AAC device allows your kid to be verbal. I'm curious about this then. If they are using an AAC device consistently, like at home and all of that, but then they won't, like in certain environments, could that be diagnosable SM?
I don't know. I think I would probably diagnose it more as general anxiety around like performance.
Okay.
Because it's a physical action of using it, even though we consider it as a way to speak because you're clicking a physical button. If I know someone has the physical ability to touch the button and I know they're using a tool at home, are they able to do it in the other places? The other thing I might consider is is it generalizable pretty quickly? Or did the child have a history of needing work to generalize the skill to other environments? So I would want to look at the pattern of that. But if they were, I might look at social anxiety. Like, is the person overwhelmed because of the environment or new people rather than the verbal inhibition? Is it more physical inhibition that is making it hard to click the button? But functionally,
yeah,
that's what it would be.
Yeah. And I know I kind of just
diagnostics are tricky, but
that's what I was just going to say. I just sprung this question on you because I got really curious. Yeah. But I also think this is an important piece of like, this is why working with a qualified mental health professional is so incredibly important that has expertise in these areas to be able to do a what we'd consider differential diagnosis like this, really looking at the functions of behavior and the patterns that are happening. And it's not a cut and dry thing. I think so often from a parenting perspective, it can be like, well, you'll get providers who are just like looking at the DSM, like a checklist, or you can even go on Google and search the DSM. But that's not how, as mental health professionals with expertise in this area, that we are approaching it. We're really looking at the picture, like you said earlier, like holistically.
Holistically. And I also think, like, when we get a tricky case, as we might, I might call Taylor and say, I have a tricky case that I need to just sort of problem solve and sort of run by you. If that's in my head, I'm talking to multiple people about how a person presents, because it's my job to get it as right as I can based on the information I have. And sometimes it's about triggering, oh, let's think about, would it be this or that? And it's not really about the information that I have. It's about what someone else is getting me to think about to make sure I get it right. And that's where professionally colleagues like you would meet. And we do that dance all the time, and it can really help us make sure we're getting to the right specific diagnostic profile. And I would like to do a plug for diagnostics are not everything at all. We talk about them this way because it helps us make sure we're using the right research to help a child. I'm not actually a fan of putting kids in boxes or adults in boxes, but they are helpful because that's how the research is done. So if your kid has any label, take that with a few grains of salt and remember that they are a person first, and your therapist should see a person first as well.
Yeah.
My flags come up and I say, let's try somebody else.
Yeah. I always say they're just a roadmap to being able to help your kid. Let's actually pivot before we go into the autism piece about SM treatment, because I do think this is where understanding, is it selective mutism, can be very insightful and beneficial, because the treatment approach, although exposure is, there's a different modality. So let's start touching on that and start sharing of, like, what does SM treatment look like?
So it's really interesting what you just said, is because, you know, when a kid has generalized anxiety or even social anxiety, the treatment, like, most providers can kind of figure that out if they haven't been trained. We know to practice hard things. We know to work on our thoughts. We do the CBT dance. But treating SM is another caliber of specificity. Mm-hmm. And I know when you did that camp, when we first talked about this, you were like, oh my gosh, it's so specific. How do you do this all the time? And my brain was trained very early to think at a level of specificity that is just beyond what I think I recognize that I naturally do now, because I started when I was 21, and which is so helpful now. But the treatment for SM, I do a treatment called parent-child interaction therapy, which is adapted for selective mutism. So PCITSM. And that is, PCIT is a treatment for kids 2 to 7, which is built for kids with ADHD and oppositional behaviors with their parents. And that is a parent-child dyadic. So you're coaching the parent to work on language usage with the child. And basically it's about, how do we neutralize and then increase demand later? So we take that same skill set from the first half of that treatment, and we help use child-directed skills like praise and reflecting what a kid is saying if they're speaking, or describing what they're doing for anything that's pro-social, so forward social motion, as I'll call it. And we want to encourage things that are part of a social interaction. The second half of it is a more typical exposure and response prevention. But the first half, that CDI, really helps with the response prevention. So we're getting a kid comfortable. So when we do give them a challenge, they're actually ready, and they're not going to completely shut down, or we're not going to totally lose them, because their experience is, my body is really good at not answering because I have this thing called SM, and it's easier to avoid because my body's learned how to keep myself safe. So what we do is, in really little increments, and I mean like a foot or sometimes an inch at a time, you come in the room, you keep them verbal, and let their body adjust at a really slow rate. So they are practicing approaching a very small goal over and over and over again. And that process itself is extraordinarily intricate for most children. And it depends on kind of their formula and how we might approach it. But what's amazing is, most of these kids have, I'd say, max 5 people that they talk to. And within an hour, most of the time, they're completely verbal with us when we do this right.
Yeah.
And it is the most beautiful, you've seen it. It's the most beautiful process. And for me, I mean, I'll get a little emotional here for a second, but it is such a privilege to get to be that person to these parents who have tried everything. They've been to play therapy. They've been to speech therapist. And not that those clinicians aren't awesome. They're awesome. It's just they don't have the right specialty to help with the specific problem, which is why the specificity is so important. But when we really overall, it's rapport and then really little pieces of brave practice that all together get us to the talking goal.
Yeah. And in this modality of treatment, I know in your practice, I also got to see this, like doing intensives is a really common modality of being able to have a long period of therapy. And it's not that you can't do it hour after hour, but the way that I learned it, I mean, we were first like, they were coming to the clinic, but then they were going to like an actual camp where it was all kids with SM and they had their safe person, which would be an assigned therapist initially that they were talking to. And then we'd like mix it up over time. But yeah, this intensive model can be really effective, which I think is different than a lot of treatment approaches.
And one of the reasons it's really effective with SM is because kids with SM or people with SM, when you're going into school, which everyone legally has to do in one way or another, right? You're going into a room where you are, questions are thrown at you all day long. What do you need? Do you want a pink one or a blue one? Do you want this or that? If I can't respond, I'm going to get really good at being scared. And so and for an extended period of time throughout the day, it's not an anxiety where I'm scared of spiders and I only feel scared of spiders when I walk across the driveway because I saw a spider there once. And like that's, you can live with that. But with SM, it is a pretty potent anxiety. It hits kids all day long and they are really tired of being anxious and their bodies are so ready to kind of be set free. And so when we put them in this intensive camp, it's set up kind of like school. So if you take a group of 4 to 7 year olds, you do morning meeting, 4 to 6 year olds maybe, and then 7 to 10, something like that. You do morning meeting, and then you do show and tell with the right supports wherever each child is. And you are going to get more progress in 5 hours than you might see in 3 months because that child has consistent feedback, consistent praise, consistent use of rewards, whatever they are working for. And all of this has been established before day one, of course. And the safe people, that person feels safe within, they've already faded in. And so you're able to do this, what we would call systematic desensitization, to use the real term, but systematic, just like steps up a ladder of difficulty, one activity at a time, that are fun and engaging with the right supports to kind of just totally crush those goals. And what we find is that a lot of the camps are actually happening right now. It's August 4th.
Yeah.
And all kind of right now before school, because we prep these kids, you get them, their kind of muscles moving, their brave muscles going is what we call them. And then they start school and we're able to fade in the teachers. And hopefully, as I joke with my patients all the time, I'm like, I hope you don't know me very well after September. I hope you don't see me. Because if you're not seeing me, that means you're not calling me. And that means that we're really well on our way and we're not having any issues.
Yeah.
So Touch
briefly on this like fade in process and why it's different than like exposure, for example, that we would do. I know you talked about the child directed interaction or CDI, but talk about the fade in and how, just for parents to understand how critical of a step that is, because I think a lot of times classic exposure treatments push the threshold almost too fast, too far.
Yeah, they go way too fast. So if you think of a typical hierarchy, right? So maybe it's 4 steps of a ladder to going to see spiders at the zoo. If I don't like spiders and for some reason I have to figure out how to be okay with that, I really only need to be able to be around it, not decompensate. Okay, we can do that. And that's like, we talk about them. We draw one. We
watch videos.
We watch a video. We listen to a spider crawling. We think about what it might be like to have a spider in the house and not know it's there. Maybe that's as far as you go, because that's functionally kind of how far we need to go to survive around a spider. But the problem with talking and SM is that there are so many pieces of an environment that can make or break an interaction for a child with SM. So we have people, places, and activities. Where the people are, how open is the door? Where are they standing? Are they facing me? Are they facing away? Are we on the computer or are we in person? All of these things, especially after COVID online learning, we figured out very quickly which was harder or easier for some kids. And we need to break down each little piece of that. And so when we're looking at fade-ins, quite literally, if this is my room, right, I'm outlining the screen if you're listening to this verbally, right? I'm on the right side. If Taylor is coming into my space, first she's going to be facing the other direction and then come into the space, just into the doorway. And then maybe she'll come a foot into the room facing the other direction. And the each step, my job as the person, if I have SM, is to keep talking. Can I keep using my brave voice while this one thing is changing every few minutes? And at some point, you would get all the way to the interaction or the game that I'm playing with my safe person that I'm already verbal with. And then you might start turning towards the table, right? But that can take an hour. It could take 10 minutes. It could take 5 minutes. It could also take, I've had them take 4 hours before. So you have this really wide range, but the whole point of a fade-in is to move systematically one step, changing one thing at a time, being really cognizant of all the things in that environment. What game are we playing? Who's there? Where are they facing? And where are we? The location. And then allowing the kid's body, the person with SM's body, to slowly get used to this uncomfortableness, this getting comfortable, being uncomfortable, continuing to talk while Taylor, a nice person, comes a little bit closer each down. And we give lots of rewards to help support that. But it's really critical because their worlds are split up into people I talk to and people I don't talk to, or places I talk, places I don't talk. And so we'll add what we start to change those boundaries through these fade-ins.
Yeah, because even places, just to explicitly point this out, sometimes like you as the parent, your child may not talk to you in a public space of some sort, even though they have the ability, they're talking to you nonstop at home, but all of a sudden you go into this public place and you find yourself constantly speaking for them too. That can be an indicator of starting to pay attention of, is that consistent? And that could be a profile of SM.
Absolutely. And a lot of the work around helping kids overcome SM is actually a parent training format. So what I say almost every day is, I'd say if not every, definitely every day, really good parents don't want their kids to be in pain. Really good parents rescue their kids. For a child that doesn't have a predisposition, so like their genetics are not ready for an onset of anxiety, they're going to be just fine. But when you have a kid who has their genetic setup, they are like ready for anxiety.
Yeah.
Might come up as SM. And actually about 70% of kids with SM have a parent who had symptoms as a child.
Oh, wow.
So we're working with an anxious parent, typically of some sort, and an anxious child who's not talking in public. An anxious reaction often is, oh my gosh, don't feel that pain. I don't want you to feel that pain because I love you so much, obviously. But we jump in because we're good parents and we say, oh my gosh, honey, you don't need to tell them. I'll tell them for you. And you do that enough for a kid who already has, they're like set and ready for SM. And we're unintentionally reinforcing that whole process accidentally. I've never seen a parent who harms their kid and does this, or isn't like very attuned to them and is rescuing them. I mean, these are really attentive, loving parents who are just so with, like so present with their kids. And it's almost like we have to teach the parent to hold back, not holding back their love or their attention by any means, but it's holding back the rescue. We're just going to wait a little bit longer after saying, honey, I know this is hard. And we're going to do it together. And this is how I'm going to help you. And that is reflective of a lot of these anxiety treatments like space, and which is a really great treatment, parent training format where you don't actually need the child. But all of those pieces of the puzzle can come in really beautifully and be able to maybe edit the environment about how we're helping our child, how we're supporting them in a different way to help them move forward and do the hard thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's so important to just remember is, yeah, you're so well-intentioned here. And at the same time, this is reinforcing. They're just, it's a form of avoidance, except it's not like an avoidance of, I don't want to do this. It's literally their body. I think of it this way because of, which we're not going to get into, but also in some ways there's parallels to the PDA profile, pathological demand avoidance, of where like the body goes into almost shutdown mode. It's like almost like this paralysis mode, totally different functions of behavior, but that's a lot of times, at least how I think of SM, is like your child's body literally doesn't know how to respond any differently.
I'll tell a kid, I'll say, I put my thumb in the middle of my hand. I say, that's your amygdala and it's flying in the wind. There's nothing protecting it. Our job is to put a blanket over it to make sure, and those are your brave muscles. We have to build your big, brave blanket to protect your amygdala, your fear center, from feeling scared. Your blanket is your practice. And so we have to practice to grow our blanket to be able to do these things like talk. And they're like, oh, okay. And then you tell the parent, okay, your job is to be set up their opportunity to build their muscles. Like you got to get them to the gym.
Yeah.
You got to drive them to the gym, their brain gym. And then they need to, then it's their job when they're ready. Well, and it's my job to help them get ready. Right. And so you get that formula together. You got to protect, put the blanket on the amygdala. So you can actually get through the thing. It's a great little analogy my kids love.
That is like amazing. Like I love it. And fun little behind the scenes, Eleanor is amazing at these analogies and like these descriptive abilities. Sometimes I'll just ask her being like, okay, here's the situation. How would you describe this? Yeah. It's so fun. So fun.
The blanket one I came up with about 3 months ago and I've used it almost every day since.
Yeah. That one is like next level, honestly.
You got to hug. I have a kid right now. She'll say, I say, okay, when our amygdala is in the wind, what do? She goes, give it a hug. I'm like, okay, aww. Now you got to practice how to give it a hug. And then we're going to be able to give it a hug in a few minutes. And then will it need a hug anymore? Will it feel so scared after we practice? No, it'll be okay then.
Yeah, I might be stealing this. I have a patient that this would be perfect for. So thank you. So let's dive into talking more about the overlap of autism and SM and differential diagnosis and what we need to be considering. Let's start off by, in your experience, what are you finding in terms of that overlap clinically?
Real quick, just a brief interruption, because I want you to know you don't have to navigate this journey alone. If you're in a place where you have concerns about your child's development, you've been on the search for a therapist that provides evidence-informed neurodivergent affirming care, or you're needing more support as a parent, the whole family approach may be a good fit for you. Autism doesn't just impact your child's life, so you deserve care that works for your child and your whole family. Head to the link in the show notes to schedule a complimentary call where we can chat about your unique circumstances. We can help you decide if Dr. Tay Concierge Clinical Care would be a good fit for your family. And if not, we will provide you resources for your next best steps.
So in my clinic and all of the clinics I've been in, which is 4 clinics, and exposed to others and helps set up camps and others, and I works with colleagues all over the country, I think clinically we would say maybe 1 out of 15 kids has both that are coming into our intensive camps, like truly has both. Now, what you do see a lot of overlap on is sensory needs, which come up with anxiety and autism. You see a lot of dysregulation in the body, which comes up with ADHD, anxiety, autism, all of it. So there's lots of symptoms and symptom profiles that fall into multiple buckets. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's both diagnostically, because I'm going to bring us back to that word, that phrase, because the function of the behavior, is it anxious avoidance? Is it a neurodevelopmental difference in ADHD or regulation or autism, right? So like you're looking at that globally. Now, from the research you and I have looked at, we've seen very different numbers.
Yeah, much higher.
Much higher. And what that makes me wonder about, and maybe we'll go over some of those numbers in a little bit, is how are people counting and when are they testing kids? Because what you often see is a kid with selective mutism who looks, for lack of a better term, spectrum-y, and I'm air quoting that if you're listening. So a kid who looks spectrum-y, so really just like repetitive behaviors, or maybe they have some stemming, but anxious people stem and have repetitive behaviors without having autism. So what we want to make sure we're doing is, and this is what I do when I have a kid with SM who might have autism as well, we need to treat the SM. We treat the anxiety. We do the same thing with ADHD and anxiety. We need to treat the anxiety to see what's left over, because ADHD and autism are both neurodivergent. And so we want to make sure we're treating and giving skill to help with the anxiety. And then we want to reassess and say, okay, what's left now? What is happening in all environments, and kind of go from there. That's how I approach it. Is that how you would as well?
Yeah, I think largely. I think it's a little different because families are often presenting to me for an autism evaluation saying, right, is this autism? And then I'm also considering like, oh, could SM be part of this profile? And so I think sometimes, you know, that, but I also think that one of the things personally that I'm going to look at a lot in terms of that differential is, what are they like at home? What in that place where their system isn't activated, or in those safe places, those safe people? I do think what's really challenging though is that, and again, this comes out of such a well-intentioned way, but a lot of times those safe people, even in safe environments, can tend to over-support autistic children. And so then it's hard to tell, like, they're like, well, yeah, they can have conversational skills, and then I'll do some probing. Okay, let's talk about what those conversational skills look like.
What do they actually sound like, right?
Yeah, exactly. Are you just asking questions? Yeah, they'll answer my questions. Okay, how often are they initiating questions with you? How often are they adding to the conversation? Things like that. But SM, when it's co-occurring with autism or suspected, does make the autism diagnostic evaluation much more tricky.
It does. The other thing, sorry, I interrupted you.
No,
the
go
other
ahead.
Thing to throw in there is that if you have a child with autism and SM truly, you might not get an accurate read on the ADOS or any of the autism tests from anybody outside of the home. And if the parent doesn't know the difference yet, just because why would you, of what they look like or why they look, a child looks different at home versus at school, if we're attributing that, the function of that behavior, to the wrong thing, then we're going to get a completely wrong read on the testing.
Exactly.
Which is very confusing and complicated and convoluted.
Exactly. And I think SM adds, like we've talked about with the slow treatment, like, well, progress, but it's not progress, but how many steps you have to take. The difference is if I have an autistic kid who, well, that I'm doing an evaluation for that has social anxiety, usually they can more rapidly habituate and get used to the environment that they're in. And so then I'm able to see that progress and see the difference between when they're anxious and not. The challenge is with a kid with SM, we're not going to see often that same progress. And so I totally agree in the sense that if they haven't had some form of treatment, unless SM is really mild, I think that kind of delaying the diagnosis of autism of like, hey, why don't we start working on this and then circle back around, I think can be really helpful. And yeah, I think is important. I will say one unique thing I do though, is I do ask parents, and with SM too, they might notice this, but you know, take a video of what your kid's like at home. Like, just set up your camera.
Every single.
Yep. Exactly. And I do that standardly in autism evaluations because I'm like, okay, I'm getting a snapshot of behavior. There's so many factors that come into this, but I think with SM, that can be a helpful metric, but it is really tricky.
And what's also really tricky, and this comes up a lot diagnostically in terms of sensory differences in children with, and people really with autism, they do shut down when they're overwhelmed, and it might be verbal and physical. And the question is often, is that because it's SM and social anxiety, or is that part of the autism? And, or is it just, you know, is it the same place every single time? Is it that physically the exact same place? Is it the same classroom? Is it the same environment that is changing the child's ability to engage? Like, what is the brick wall that the kid is hitting? and why is it there? But sensory overwhelm or understimulation, all of those things can change our ability to use our language without it being SM.
Yeah.
Which is super confusing. Again, plug for someone who really knows what they're doing and talking about. But those diagnostic complexities, as a parent, you can think about, okay, what do I think is happening here? And you don't need to know the clinical terminology to understand this at all. It's actually better if you don't, in my opinion, when someone's telling me about it, because we can get stuck in the language. Yep. It just gets junky and jumbled. But if you say, okay, so I think what happened is my child, like, so Joey came in the room and they stopped talking, but they were still able to play in the way they play at home. Okay. That's more like SM versus Joey and Susie came in the room and it got really loud. And then my child stopped talking and moving, or then my child had a tantrum or a meltdown. That is more spectrumy behavior of sensory overwhelm. And the difference is the function of what happened, which is a very interesting thing.
Yeah. And just a little, I talk about this episode a lot, but episode 10 talks about the ABCs. It's called the ABCs of challenging behavior, but you can also go back, listen to that episode. You can start taking data for yourself where you, again, you don't need to know all of this terminology, but being able to come to a clinician and be like, here's what I'm noticing, or just even just hand over the data to us. We'll do all the interpretation for you, I think can be helpful.
100%. Often before I do an intake with a family, I'll start a Google Doc and or a Google Excel sheet and say people, places, activities, what comes before the meltdown. And it's getting to the ABCs, yep. Antecedent behavior consequences for those of you who are in the field. But the looking at that, and what I find is when I prompt a parent to start thinking about it, they're not even sure what they're looking for. I'm just like, write everything down. And then we look at it together and say, okay, which patterns do you see here? Then very quickly, especially when we're doing differentials, we're able to figure out cause and effect of people, places, activities, whether it's SM, or if we have a child who may be diagnosed with autism, I'm collecting data to give the evaluator to support whatever the conclusion is one way or another. But data is really helpful to sort of demystify the complexities between it, because the numbers don't lie, which
Absolutely.
Is great.
Absolutely.
Consistently.
Okay. Let's real quick touch on, because we said at the beginning of the episode, we would touch on this idea of topics of interest, right? And being able to talk about dinosaurs, but nothing else. And you were talking about feeling like you're an expert in it. What do you find if you are thinking about this difference between a special interest and just the comfortability of talking about the topic?
That's a really good question. So this comes up a lot in SM. And so in the Thetans and the way we treat SM, we'll start there and then come back to the special interest piece. We actually start with fact-based information most of the time, because for a young child, colors, numbers, letters, things that princesses, like, everybody knows who Elsa is. Everybody knows the Cars characters, right? Like those, when I'm working with a child through exposures, helping them learn how to talk about a new topic, we start with fact-based things because it is easier. Categorically, giving opinions is much harder in a child or person with SM, because what if you think my opinion's wrong, or you don't like my opinion, or you like something different that might look negative towards me. And that's very social anxiety-esque, but it's this kind of aura of SM, right? And so oftentimes when we get a kid talking and they're able to answer 2 + 2 = 4 or 3 + 3 = 6, if you say 10 + 10 and they haven't done double digits yet, they might go nonverbal, because saying I don't know is really hard. That is different than a topic, right? The difficulty increased too far for them to be able to say it. But can I confirm their answer that 10 + 10 = 20 on paper and then say, what's 10 + 10? 20. Yes. That's a pretty reasonable progression for a kid who's learning math in terms of learning how to speak while doing math. If you add special interests in, right, or preferred topics are going to be, think of them as comfort zones. And special interests in autism are going to be more obsessive, and it's hard to talk about anything else. And so Yes. If you have a person with SM, truly SM and autism, absolutely. We're going to work with the special interests and have them tell us about that, because that person is going to be a heck of a lot more motivated to talk about the thing that they love, which is awesome.
Which, to just interject real quick, like, is the definition of neurodivergent affirming care. You're 100%. Following their interests to support
them. Always going to follow interests and start there. Now, are we also down the line, once a kid is completely verbal in the comfort zone topic, whether it's a special interest or I like princesses a lot and I want to talk about princesses, totally, we're going to push it. Because to be a person that's able to access your education, you need to be able to talk about lots of different things. Now, we're going to do neurodivergent affirming care in the approach of that, in how long we do it. We're not going to push it when it's miserable. We are going to say, when you're ready, we're going to practice talking about addition numbers or blocks. And then after we're done with that activity, we'll come back to your favorite thing, dinosaurs. And when you're doing neurodiversity affirming care in whatever person you're working with, it's finding a balance of give and take, and how can you as a clinician build tolerance for talking about something that's a little bit less comfortable, but not uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because we do not want to make somebody do something that's miserable, and you can't make anyone do anything. So it's not worth trying.
Yeah.
That just ends up being a terrible disaster in every way. And it's awful.
Yeah.
When you can happen.
Yeah. And I think this real quick point on this, because we could literally have an entire episode on this, but this idea of, what'd you say?
Maybe we should.
Maybe we should. This idea of evidence-based treatments, things that we know work, and then that intersection with neurodivergent affirming care, it does get a little tricky sometimes in learning how to navigate. But this is where I think a clinician having knowledge in both of these can flexibly go from one to the other. I often say in the care I'm doing, I'm using evidence-informed principles. I might not do it exactly like it was initially studied, because a lot of times it wasn't studied in neurodivergent individuals. It was studied in neurotypical individuals with anxiety. And there are some exceptions to that, but it's so fascinating to think about. But yeah, that flexibility there, I do think, is so important. The other thing I would note about like special interests is you also are going to hear that topic, I think, more in their safe place and safe people. Like, you're going to hear about it over and over again.
And or in times of distress.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, but I mean, I think overall, I think parents, if you're listening to this, is probably one of the most complex differential diagnoses, I would say, of autism versus SM. I think in part too, because then we're also bringing in a really high likelihood of social anxiety. And that is a tricky differential as well. It's like, well, do they not want to interact with their peers because they feel anxious, or do they not want to interact with their peers because they prefer to play by themselves? And again, we look at function of behavior, and sometimes the function in kids can become a little ambiguous because it's like a chicken and an egg type of thing.
I also, what's really interesting about this though, is that I will say my kids that have autism and SM, you give them some numbers about how to rate how difficult something is, they might look absolutely miserable and be like, totally fine, which is a pretty common thing in SM, where they're freaking out and so anxious. They're level 10 anxiety, but they look totally fine. So after the age of 4, you can almost ask, once they're talking to you consistently, or do a nonverbal way to communicate, I'll do like 1, 2, and 3. One, this is easy, medium, or hard. And if I'm not sure if they're going to be able to tell me verbally, I'll say, show me how hard it is on your hands. And that's established. They can do that. And then I'll say, 1, do you understand what to do? Or 2, 1, do you not understand what to do? Or 2, is it anxiety provoking? Like, are you having a hard time doing it? And they can tell you, like, I don't know what to say, or I'm freaking out. And so kids are pretty good in the moment of saying, if you teach them how to do a sense scale, clinicians, that's your 1 to 10 or 1 to 5 anxiety rating scale. But And parents, you can do this too, but like they can tell you more than you think, and take everything with a grain of salt just because their age, but you can get a lot of that. And it's going to help with some of those differentials and understanding what's actually happening and sort of curiously evaluating and looking at, oh, what's kind of creating the wall here? What's the stuck point? Is it anxiety or is it a lack of ability, or do we have a skill deficit?
Yeah, I will say one thing with a SUD scale that I have found a lot of, because I use it quite a lot, and not saying necessarily with co-occurring SM, but just generally, sometimes autistic kiddos do make up their own scale. Like you might rate it something and they're going to rate it something else. So you do want to calibrate that and get this sense. Like say you give them a scale of 10 and they only really use 1 to 3, well, then their 3 is really maybe like an 8 or 9 in yours. And you can do some gentle teaching of that. But I also find sometimes autistic kiddos can get a little hyperfixated. Like I had one who would be like, it is a 7.6429. And I'd be like, okay. And then they'd come down and be like, it's a 7.6248. And I'm like, okay, but we're going down. That's all that I
and they understand like this. It's not for lack of understanding. I think also when a brain is so specific, you can add a lot of humor in. You'll be like, well, that wasn't a lot. Yeah. We need to make it go down further. Give me an idea about how to make it go down further. And they can tell you. They'll be like, exactly. All right, well, we need to do blah, 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 blah. And they have a whole plan. It's amazing. Exactly. And just throwing this out there also, if you have co-occurring ADHD, it's just good for people to know when you, especially if you have all three, when you treat the SM, you might see this like burst of behaviors, of all kinds of behaviors. Give it some time. Let the kids get used to being able to talk in public before you start making assumptions. My rule is at least 3 months before I add another diagnosis. We want to give it a semester to kind of like calibrate and then learn the social construct of talking within the setting of school or whatever it is. And so all of those things, when you treat one thing, sometimes a burst, a new skill develops, and give it time to kind of recalibrate before you start making assumptions or putting your kids in boxes unintentionally.
Yeah.
But it's good to just keep an eye on and take some data on over time.
That's a great tip. I mean, and I think is really important of allowing them to get back to baseline state.
Yeah. Baseline state. And can we figure out what they look like in multiple environments talking? And then like, do they feel, they might know they feel a little bit chaotic because they're still a little bit anxious.
Right.
Because some kids will, it's not uncommon for kids to kind of overcorrect. They'll start yelling out in class or like, and because they've never had to inhibit themselves, which is like a normal thing for kids to have to learn. But most kids learn it at 3 and 4, and an SM kid might not learn it till 8 when they get or not.
And also sometimes talking about the sensory element, sensory regulation, movement-based things are a form of sensory regulation. And so your kid might be fidgeting a lot more than you're used to seeing. It could be that they're learning that is regulating their nervous system. And as the anxiety keeps going down, they don't need that as much, which is different. It has a different function of behavior than ADHD does.
So. And a lot of kids, and the kids that you see that in, usually they're, in my experience, they're over like 6. They can tell you, my brain is bouncing or I'm nervous.
Yeah.
If you do a good job, or if your clinician's doing a good job teaching what feelings are, and I usually kind of wrap around back to it when you start to see that stuff. Okay, let's figure out what's happening in our body today.
Yeah.
I feel nervous and that can feel like A, B, C, or D, or I feel antsy. I feel like I have ants in my pants and that feels like 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever it is. That can be really helpful with some of those differentials over time. You just repeatedly reteach and eventually we're able to kind of figure it out. Totally. And teachers know a lot. They know what ADHD looks like.
Yeah.
So for sure. They're good collaborators there.
Yeah. Any other key information about SM you feel like we haven't touched on?
I think one of the things that is lost a lot in the world of SM is that it's extraordinarily treatable. Most kids get better. I see adults sometimes that have SM. Most of the time they end up coming to me because their children come to me. And then after their children get better, they'll want some help, or they kind of get better while their kid gets better because they learn how to be brave together. So if you are someone who feels like your kid fits this profile and you are an anxious person, you deserve help too. I find that it's this like piece of the puzzle that a lot of people forget about. We forget to take care of the adult that's helping the anxious kid. because we're supposed to do everything for our children in 2023 and nothing for ourselves. And I really just encourage you to reach out. A couple other things that are helpful in terms of resources, if we want to go over some of that.
Yeah. And also comment on how people can work with you as well.
Yeah. So I have a private practice in Nashville. It's called Child and Family Therapy Collective. And in the next couple of months, I'll be licensed in probably 4 or 5 states in the Southeast, just sort of to increase care access for people with SM and really any comorbidity and in within my specialty. And then I'm on Instagram at Grow Little Minds. I do a lot of psychoeducational teaching for parents. So there's lots of workshops on there for more neurotypical kids and anxiety kids and a lot of parent help to align values and how you're using the tools that are out there in an aligned way for you. And the other thing that's a really amazing resource for SM is I am on the board of the Select and Mutism Association, and we offer so many free resources. It is unreal. So if you go to selectandmutism.org, you can see all of that there. There are free workshops with my colleagues across the world, and there's some really good stuff on there.
Awesome. And really you, just to clarify, you were saying, and it makes sense, like you were saying, like neurotypical kids with anxiety in terms of courses and such like that. Where would you say, though, if parents are kind of already have the autism diagnosis, considering is SM part of this? Any resources come to mind there?
I do lots of consults with people outside of clinical care. I think it's more about finding someone who's an expert in what they're doing. And I don't like that word, but who has a lot of experience in helping in the differential diagnostic and in the treatment process. But I'm happy to direct based on where you are. But the Select and Mutism Association is going to be a great place to start as well.
Yeah, I like to think of it. I've switched. Expert is such a weird word to specialization, and you are highly specialized in this. And similarly, I will say this is something too, if you need, I can connect you with Eleanor, you can reach out to her directly. I'm also happy to provide some guidance around this. Definitely SM is her specialty in and out. And probably the next time I get an SM case, I will be like, okay, Eleanor, let's do some case consult around this. And we do it literally all the time for each other. The other day we were chatting about a case of hers of an autistic teen who maybe has the PDA profile. And it's really, I think good clinicians do that. They know their boundaries and know where that specialty is. So I think even if you're like, okay, neither one of you are fitting into what we're looking for, we have someone we're looking for, don't be afraid to ask questions about what their knowledge is. I think I always say it's like finding a therapist. It's like a first date, right? You got to even decide.
100% like a first date. Yeah, really. I do a lot of free consults, and I'll be like, I give my whole thing. And usually they're about half an hour. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm not the right person for you. And a parent will be like, yes, you are. And I'm like, no, I'm not. And this is why. And they don't understand that. But it's really important to me that I know that I'm not the right fit for somebody because my vibe is pretty direct. And if they're needing something a little bit more, whatever, I can handhold you all day long, but I'm not going to not tell you what's going on. I'm also not going to jump and put your kid in a box. I don't do that because kids don't deserve to be in boxes.
Yeah.
Labels are silly. Absolutely. They do help us choose good research, but that's the only benefit we have.
Yeah. Yeah. Can give that clarity. Like I said, it's a roadmap. And I think, that like obsession of, what exactly is this? It's like, what are we working on? What are our goals? Do we have clarity on that? Let's go down that path. So,
yeah, all of that to say is I think both of us are more than happy to make sure people get to where they need to go. And if I don't have the answer, maybe you do and vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, especially if you're in the Southeast region, definitely reach out to Eleanor, follow her on Instagram. We will link all of that. We'll also link the Selective Mutism Association's website so you can click that. And this was just a little bit of a different perspective, but I also think is really important because I think I at least find sometimes parents aren't aware of talk about labels and diagnoses, but aren't aware of this diagnosis. And so then it can be confusing on how to support your child if you're experiencing this when they're not talking consistently.
I would argue that a lot of parents of typically developing children also have no idea what SM is. And totally. Most parents find me because they Google, my child isn't talking at school. That's how that most of them figure it out, not their pediatrician, not the first therapist they've had. They're treating something else, or a sibling's therapist gets it wrong, not because they're not great therapists, but just because they don't have the context. So it's definitely a really important conversation to have. And we know that when there is anxiety in a family, all of these things are going to be more likely, and it all kind of piles on. And so the kind of maybe to tie it in is, even if like your kid has some of the symptoms, you might not have a full diagnosis. That doesn't mean it doesn't deserve to be treated.
Exactly.
Do the treatment without a diagnosis. Even if we're just kind of exploring what it might look like, all of those pieces of the puzzle are incredibly important to make sure kids are taken care of in a holistic manner.
Yeah. And sometimes in those cases, a few sessions is all you need to get that boost, to get that support, and you're on your way. And I think that's something important to keep in mind too, that committing to treatment, especially for something like SM, it is so highly treatable that progress can happen really fast. And it's, like you said, it's beautiful to watch.
It's really such a privilege to be part of.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here today. This was awesome.
Absolutely. So much fun.
All right, y'all, that is a wrap of today's episode of Evolve with Dr. Tay. I will see you back here soon. Before we wrap up this episode, for real this time, I want to share a couple ways you can get even more value and what your next steps could be. First, join the Evolve Facebook group. We do Q&As about the episodes and so much more. I linked that group, my personal social media pages, and any resources I mentioned in this episode in the show notes. So scroll down now and join me online. When you submit questions on any of my pages, your question could be featured on this podcast. How cool is that? I love being able to speak on topics that feel directly relevant to your life. Your questions truly make a difference in the content we create here. One last thing, do your fellow autism parents a favor. Share this episode on your social media and tag me. Autism currently affects 1 in 36 families in the United States and many more worldwide. So I'm sure there is a parent in your social media followers that could be served by this podcast. Thank you again for being here, and I'm so grateful we shared this time together. Bye, y'all.